Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/bookshow. Then go over to morbidlybeautiful.com as we are now part of the Morbidly Beautiful Podcasting Network.
Now, here is a motion picture film.
And now, ladies and gents, it's show time!
To do the bimes.
Say hello to my little friend.
Go ahead. Make my day.
Come quietly or there will be trouble.
I'll shove that bat up your ass and turn you into a popsicle.
Inconceivable.
Welcome to the All-American Spook Show Podcast.
I'm sorry, boys. I'm afraid I can't do that. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the All-American Spook Show Podcast. I'm Josh and I'm joined here with Tiana.
Hi.
And the Professor Smoke.
What's up?
Will and Donnie, once again, just like last week, they had some stuff going on. They couldn't make it, but we're diving into the latest in our Cult Corner series. Now, the whole premise of the Cult Corner is essentially movies we like, you know, cult favorites and stuff that aren't horror related. So we all nominate a movie. We put it on a wheel, we spin it, and kind of eliminate the movies, and then it lands on the last one that it lands on, or the last one to survive the spins, I guess. That's what we watch. And this time it was a movie that I nominated that actually won the spin, and we're going to be talking about Highlander from 1986. That's what we just watched. So it was one that I watched a handful of times throughout the years, and growing up when I was a lot younger, I used to like this one. But it did become a whole series, and we'll get into that. I mean, it spawned four more sequels and an entire series that ran for a good portion of the 90s, but we'll get into what happened there with Highlander. But before we dive into it, you know, some of the background and our thoughts and everything on it, I'll go ahead and throw out that you should visit aaspookshow.com. That's the center of the Spook Show universe. From there, you can go listen to our past podcast archives. All 209 or so previous episodes should be there or easily found from there. And you can also find our YouTube channel from there, where every month, we have series called Video Vortex, Grindhouse Gutter, Hammer Horror in Order. Those come out just about every week, every month. And we also upload episodes of the podcast over there. So, you know, if you don't necessarily listen to them on a podcast catcher, you can check them out over on YouTube. And if this is where you're listening to it, we appreciate it. And go check out all the other stuff on the channel while you're here. And subscribe and click the bell to be notified and all that jazz. You know, look, if you watch stuff on YouTube, you know the drill. So go do that, please. And drop us a 5-star review here on if you're listening to us on Apple Podcast. We don't mention that enough, but that, you know, the more 5-star reviews there we get, the more people their algorithms and all that jazz play out and gets us the podcast out to more ears. So if you'll give us a 5-star review, we would appreciate that. But that's enough of that. We'll go ahead and toss to the trailer for Highlander from 1986.
From another time comes a man of great power.
Talk funny, Nash. Where are you from?
Lots of different places. A warrior of incredible strength.
You've the devil in you.
We've been kinsmen 20 years.
Connor MacLeod was my kinsman. I don't know who you are.
Because you were born different, men will fear you, try to drive you away.
A man uncertain of his future.
What you got here, Brenda, is a guy who's been creeping around since at least 1700.
It's not possible.
And haunted by his past.
Wait a minute, Nash. I want some answers.
You cannot die, MacLeod.
I am Connor MacLeod of the Clan MacLeod. I was born in 1518 in the village of Glenfinnan on the shores of Loch Shiel. I am immortal.
A hero who is about to face his greatest challenge.
You will always be weaker than I.
What can you tell me about a 7-foot lunatic hacking away with a broadsword at 1 o'clock in the morning in New York City in 1985?
Not much.
For he is not alone.
In the end,
There can be only one.
Highlander, there can be only one.
Here we are, we're the princes of the universe. Here we belong, fighting for survival. We've come to be the rulers of you all.
All right, there you go. That's the trailer for that. So, Smoke, what's your history with old Highlander? I assume this isn't the first time you've seen this one.
No. I unfortunately didn't see it in the theater back when it first came out. And apparently a lot of other people didn't either. And I'm sure you'll get to that with the budgets and all that stuff. I just remember this taking off more on video. And that's where I saw it for the first time, was on VHS or whatever, renting it. I saw it multiple times back then. I mean, I don't know how many times I've seen it over the years. It's been quite a few, more than a handful, I'll put it that way. But yeah, it's one I've always loved. From the soundtrack to the flow of the movie to the cool looking swords and shit. He has all kinds of different swords in this movie. There's like the look of the Kurgan, like not just when he's in the modern times, but when he's back in like when they go back flashbacks to prior times and like Scotland and whatnot. His battle armor was awesome, I always thought. You know, mm-hmm. It's not practical. I mean, he's got the skull. He's this badass, like, skull armor, which, you know, when you're trying to use armor, I don't think skulls are the best things.
Probably not.
A sword or a battle axe is going to crush that skull, and then it's going to cleave your head, and then it's going to crush your skull. And but at least you'd look really cool.
Yeah.
You know, when it happened. But I've always loved this movie. All that stuff I just mentioned. And I always thought that it was put together well, and I didn't realize it until doing really the research for this, that the director was into music videos. This is the first actual movie he directed.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes sense going back. Like, you look at this movie, you can tell, I mean, the way that the Queen soundtrack worked into it and all that stuff. I always loved all that, and I didn't realize this guy's on top of it. And I never really dug down the rabbit hole of who this director was back then. And, but yeah, now I can see why.
No, absolutely. Yeah. Russell Mulcahy. Yeah. You can definitely see it for sure. Tiana, what about you? Is this first time or one of many?
Oh no. One of many. Hmm. This is one of my favorites. I remember watching it with my dad a lot.
This one always stuck out for me back in the day because of the soundtrack. I mean, I've always been a huge Queen fan. I mean, arguably probably my favorite band, me personally. So this one has always had a special place in my heart because of that.
Yeah, I agree with also this song, the Princes of the Universe, mm-hmm. It was on an album, right? But it was this movie, I think, that really pushed that song, for me anyways. Because
yeah, now I don't think they ever actually released a formal soundtrack for this movie. I mean, it's got, you know, it's wall-to-wall Queen, right? But never got released as a soundtrack for Highlander. It was more or less some combination of stuff they recorded for this and A Kind of Magic album.
Yeah.
By Queen.
Yeah, but I mean, the lyrics of this song, of course, play out like kind of what's going on with the whole battle. You know, the Princes of the Universe the lyrics to that song. And it became one of my favorite Queen songs. And I don't know that it's necessarily anybody else's or everybody else's or what, you know, how it's seen discography of Queen.
Yeah.
But I think it's like this movie. Every time I hear that song, I can't help but think of the scenes in this movie. And I mean, it's on just about every 80s playlist I ever make on Spotify.
Yeah.
I put Prince of the Universe. If I only have one Queen song on it, and I don't, I mean, I have plenty of Queen songs on the list, but if I were only put one Queen song on a list, it might be Princess of the Universe, and probably because of the visuals from this movie I get when I hear the song.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. You think of, like, especially towards the end, you know, with the final, the big dramatic final battle and everything. Yeah. Like, it plays so well. And like you said, it does play out like a music video. So you can see it and you can hear it when you know what I mean? You can see these things play out when you hear it. So I totally agree with it there. I mean, like, even the song Who Wants to Live Forever, that was written by Brian May of Queen. And that was essentially after he watched scenes of the movie playing out. So that was directly written for this. And that became a hit for them. One of their last hits before Freddie Mercury's unfortunate passing in what, 91, 92 when he passed. But yeah, I mean, like, but it's unfortunate that they never actually released a proper soundtrack of this, though.
Because
there are some songs and some of the score and stuff that just, I guess, never got released on anything official like that.
And I don't know why. I mean, I don't know what the reasoning for that was, why it never really got. I mean, it's a lot of movies got released around that time. I mean, we're talking about 1986, so it wasn't like early 80s or anything.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know. And this movie's very visual. I mean, visual, but very much. I mean, because he's a music director or director of music videos, music plays a key role in it. So yes, it's ironic that it never got a proper soundtrack.
Yeah, because apparently there was like a CD that got released in the mid-90s called Highlander, the Original Scores, but it had kind of a combination of some of the music from the first three movies. This isn't, you know, this wasn't like the complete soundtrack score and everything from Highlander. It was like, here's a little bit from 1, 2, and 3. But I think that's about the only thing that even comes close to a soundtrack that ever got released for it, other than just listening to the Queen album, A Kind of Magic, and then I think there was a song or two from the previous album, The Works, by Queen that had Hammer to Fall and maybe some other stuff that they used in the movie. But but they weave it in good in this movie, though. You know, it's not just like, hey, we got Queen to do this, this is awesome. No, it's like, let's make it a part of it. You know, it's almost like certain things were written for it, and then other things you could tell it's almost like they shot with it, you know? So they did a good job of working the two things together.
Yeah, like I said, I never really looked up the director's name before on this, but I mean, I knew his name, but I never went that any deeper than that into it. And I mean, it makes sense that the music plays such a key role in it and works its way in the movie so well is because he was a music video director. Now, I know one of the music videos he directed was the first music video MTV ever aired, and it was the Buggles, you know, Video Killed the Radio Star.
Well, there you go. Was that not the first video that ever played on MTV?
Yeah, that was the first one that they opened with on. I don't have the date. I don't even remember exactly what year it was.
81, 82, 83, somewhere around there, I think.
Yeah, but yeah, I know for sure. I know that was the first music video, first thing that ever played on MTV. Period, was that music video.
It's nice to see that they put some thought into that. You know. What's the very first thing we're going to play on music television, you know, that it's very good. Very good call on that one. If you're going to do it, let's do that. That's perfect. Yeah. Anyways. So some of the background, info that we usually spit out here, we've got, this movie released, in 1986 on, well, it actually played, it debuted in January of 86 at the Avoriaz Fantastic Film Festival in France, but then it opened wide in the United States March 7th of 1986. Not really any, groundbreaking other alternate titles for this one. I mean, there was some other translations and stuff like that, and I think it was called The Immortals in a couple of countries, but that was about the only other extent, you know, of any kind of difference. Mostly it was just Highlander or some variation of that. Wherever it got released, it's rated R. If you've ever seen it, you'd understand that. And it's a long one, though, a lot longer than our usual fare here for sure. It's 1 hour and 56 minutes, but it doesn't seem like the pacing's pretty good. I mean, like, yeah, at some points it kind of drags, but it doesn't feel like a really, really long, almost 2 hour movie in a lot of ways. Right.
No, I think they did. I think if he had lost anything, it would have felt weird. I don't think there was anything in this movie he could have cut out to make it shorter, but like you said, that didn't need that because the pacing, it doesn't feel like you're watching a 2 hour movie.
There, like I said, a couple of scenes that kind of play out a little, you know, longer, but for the most part, it's got a good pacing. So it definitely does not feel like that for sure. Whenever we have the box office numbers, we'll throw those out there. Now, from what I can tell, this was done, for a budget of $19 million, but only went on to make worldwide, depending on which numbers you see. Now, I have two different varying numbers. I've got one that was just, it only made $5.9 million, which is not good on a budget of 19, right? But then I see another number, and this is actually on Wikipedia. So they attribute it, I'll look up what they attribute it to, but they say it's $12.8 million, which is a little better, but I don't see their source.
While you're looking that up, I think I heard also one thing was that they didn't promote it that well. Like one of the original poster for it that was out, or promotional material, was like a close up of Christopher Lambert's face. Mm-hmm. And that was about it. And it wasn't like, I mean, you wouldn't have, if you hadn't known what it was about or watched the trailer, at least of it, you wouldn't have even known from the poster or been able to guess. Cause I've seen it, that poster they're talking about. You wouldn't even be able to guess what the hell the movie was about. Hmm. I mean, not the title Highlander, you would hope that maybe it's about, you know, the Highlands, the Highlanders of Scotland or whatever, you by the title, but you wouldn't know it by the poster.
Yeah, according to Wikipedia, that 12.8 number comes from a website called The Numbers, which I guess is kind of like Box Office Mojo. It's another box office tracking website. So somewhere in between, I guess, lies, because that's a pretty big discrepancy, 12.8 to one saying 5.9. So somewhere the truth probably lies somewhere in the middle, like they say, right? But I don't know. But domestically here in the U.S., though, it opened up that weekend of March 7th through the 9th, 1986, and it was number 7 in the box office. But I've got the top 10, so I'll go ahead and run through them. Number 10, FX. Sorry. It was in its 5th week. Number 9, Out of Africa, was in its 12th week. Number 8, Murphy's Romance, was in its 11th week. And then there at number 7, Highlander debuted with 2.4 million, and that was the big opener that week, because the only other ones that opened up that particular weekend were number 12, Nomads, and number 14, A Room with a View. So it was the big, you know, new kid on the block that weekend. Number 6 was Wildcats. Number 5, Hannah and Her Sisters. Number 4, The Color Purple. That was in its 12th week and still doing pretty well. Number 3, Down and Out in Beverly Hills. Number two, Smoke, This Is For You, House. It was actually number 2 in the box office that weekend. And that one made 3.6 million for, at that point, was after 2 weeks, was 11.2 million. So it was doing pretty well. And number 1 in the box office, though, that weekend was Pretty in Pink. And its 2nd week was doing pretty good numbers. So I guess no surprise there. But yeah, I mean, like there's some a couple of those are bona fide classics, like The Color Purple, you know, some favorites like Pretty in Pink, stuff like that. So it's always interesting to look back on these, box office numbers when we have them, especially from back in 1986.
Yeah.
But the movie was produced by Peter S. Davis and William N. Panzer, and the production companies were Thorn EMI Screen Entertainment, Highlander Productions, and Davis Panzer Productions. Now, if you'll notice, and I'm sure you noticed it when you popped it in and watched it, did you see the Canon logo at the beginning of it?
Yep.
Now, it wasn't produced by then. This wasn't a Golden Globus production, so this doesn't count as a Cannon Fodder episode, but I'm guessing it must have been distributed in some other countries. I think it was one of those titles that was distributed in some certain places, and there was some kind of working agreement, because it was distributed by Thorn EMI Screen Entertainment through, now get all these names, Columbia, Cannon, Warner Distributors in the UK, and then 20th Century Fox here in the US and Germany. So I guess the Canon logo just gets stuck on there because of the distribution in the UK through some weird agreement that they had. And you know, we've talked about that before on Canon Fodder, right? Where Canon had some working agreements with HBO and Warner Brothers and all that. So it must have something to do with those ties, right?
Yes, I remember in Canon, when it came to home video too, there was some of those. I don't know if you remember. I know this with the VHS collecting, like Thorn EMI, they had that certain particular white clamshell cases, right, with their things in them. And I remember, and they had a whole bunch of different other companies tacked on sometimes, and one of them was Canon. Some of those old tapes, they got released through Thorn, I guess Thorn EMI, Canon, or Columbia Pictures too, like you said. So and maybe that was before, I don't know, because Canon also had their own Canon video label as well, so. But yeah, like you said, it had to do with distribution in certain areas, I guess.
Yeah, it must have been some super agreement between like 3 or 4 major studios to just like get this thing out in different countries, and this just kind of got tied up in there. But it is kind of, it seems like an outlier that the Canon logo still lives on this thing, because, and that's the other thing too, to me, it doesn't feel, you know, and for right reasons, I guess, but it doesn't feel like it belongs there. Like, you know, like, this doesn't feel Canon to me.
Yeah, you can definitely tell that it's, like you said, it's something distribution-wise, not production-wise.
Yeah. Yeah, but it first caught me off guard before I did all that homework, and I'm like, Canon, what the fuck? You know, wait a minute, this isn't Canon Fodder, is it? And then I had to, you know, wait a minute, this is Cult Corner, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, it kind of caught me off guard at first. I'm like, wait a minute, I don't remember seeing Highlander on the list, but that's why.
And, also, I mean, it doesn't mean that they maybe they did donate some or give some, or not donate.
Donate.
Lobos weren't donating anything, but I mean, you know, a return on their investment type thing. They might have put into it something, you know, but it definitely didn't produce it as far as it being a Golden Globus style movie. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, maybe they did give some funding for it outside of just distribution. I'm not sure of all that. I mean, something, yeah, like you said, it must be something that they have worked to get that logo on every print of the movie.
And it still lives there.
Yeah.
Because I don't know how you guys watch it this time around, but I watched it on a more recent, you know, I'm not sure exactly when it was released, but it was a 4K UHD that I watched it on, and it's still got the Canon logo on there. So there's some in perpetuity agreement going on there, right?
Yeah, that's what we watched it on too, with the 4K. I think it was the Steelbook edition that came out somewhere on Best Buy, maybe, or something. Best Buy Steelbook edition. But I think it's the same disc you got, the 4K one.
Probably.
And it's still on the front and center.
Now, on the front of mine, on the box at least, it said director's cut. But I'm not sure if what I watched was that. I mean, because the runtime jives with, you know, the runtime that I'm seeing. So I don't even know exactly how many alternate versions there are of this thing floating around.
I don't know. I couldn't tell you all the differences, but I do know that the European version, and I don't know by European, I don't know if that meant was longer or had more to it, a few scenes than the American, but I can't say, I can't point to you. I don't know exactly what those scenes were. I just know that it was a little bit longer, or at least had alternate scenes of some sort in the European version than in the American one. So I'm assuming the director's cut maybe is that one.
It must be. And that jives, if you think about it, what you just said, that jives with the Canon logo being on there, because it was distributed partly by them in the UK by Canon. So maybe that's what we are looking at here. That means somebody's listening. Listening to this and yelling at us, you watch the European version, you fools. Yeah.
I know. Yeah. We didn't delve quite that deep, unfortunately. I didn't think about it until just now when you were talking about that.
Honestly, yeah.
Same. About the different cuts, I do remember hearing that there was, that it was a European cut was different, or I don't know if it was some stuff replaced other stuff, or if some stuff was cut out, or if there was added stuff. I don't know.
It's been so long since I've watched this movie from beginning to end, I couldn't tell you. Because, like, honestly, I've seen this movie a number of times, and it's always been a favorite of the 80s for me, but legitimately, I haven't watched it in 20, 25 years. Like, you know, from beginning to end. It's been a long time.
Yeah.
Myself, so I couldn't tell you. It hasn't been recent enough to tell you the differences.
Yeah, same here. I mean, we might have seen it some few years back, but before that, it had been a while.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It was directed, like we said, by Russell McKay. It was writing credits. It's a story by Gregory and screenplay by Gregory Wyden. The screenplay was also written by Peter Bellwood and Larry Ferguson. It was... Hold on, I lost. Okay, it was produced by Peter S. Davis, like I mentioned a minute ago, and William N. Panzer. The music, the actual score of the movie, other than Queen working on that, right, was Michael Kamen. The cinematographer was Jerry Fisher, and it was edited by Peter Honus. And I mentioned those two because the look of this movie, especially in some of those key scenes toward the end, but really throughout the whole movie, right, it's edited so well and shot so well. I mean, it really does look great. And I think that was a huge element as to why this thing was as successful, probably, as it was, at least cult wise, because it's got a pretty cool story and it looks great.
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely, the visuals always struck me with this movie. Even the first time I saw it back in whatever, in the 80s, whenever it was, I first saw it on renting it, like I said, on home video, but that stuck with me the whole time. It was visual in the way that something like fantasy movies of the time, Legend or Lady Hawk or those types of movies, those fantasy movies. Although this one always stuck out even more so to me. That, like I said, I didn't know what it was because I didn't delve down that until finding out that he was a music video director first. Yeah. I think I do remember now reading something that was some of the criticisms that the movie got back then, was that it was criticized some by especially American film critics. Over the fact of it, the look of it being, and not that they said it looks like a music video, but that's what they were like basically describing. Their criticism of it was those shots that made it look like a music video without them saying that's what it was. You know, without them saying, yeah, we hate it because it looks like a music video. Yeah. That's basically what they were saying.
Yeah.
So at least in America, they were criticizing it for that. And that could have been, maybe that was some of the reason why it didn't do as well at the box office, because of the negative criticism.
Yeah, to say it was tepid at best. I've got a couple of quotes, necessarily, you know, some words on the responses, the critical response to this. Variety said there were entertaining moments, but the, quote, total work is a mess. And then People described it as, quote, a moody combination of Blade Runner, The Terminator, and your last really good nightmare.
That sounds like something I'd want to go see.
That's not a dig. Oh, wait a minute. You know what? I wasn't going to watch this movie, but now I am. Thanks, people. That probably would have been the response from a young Professor Smoke back in the 80s, right?
Yeah.
It's the opposite of what something like Fangoria or something would say about it. Oh, it sucks. Yeah, I got to go see it.
I don't know what struck. Well, you know, all these, who knows what strikes something off this way, but why it became such a huge cult hit on. Well, I mean, why is it? Because I think it's a great movie. I just don't know what the discrepancy was in the box office versus how it took off on home video, you know?
Yeah.
But I mean, these things happen.
Who knows? Yeah. I mean, maybe it just wasn't the right moment for it. You know, you never know about those type of things. Cause sometimes, like, if it had been a year earlier or a year later, maybe it's a different story, but maybe just in that time period, people just weren't, you know, they weren't going for it. Who knows? I mean, we just read the top 10 in the box office that particular weekend, so maybe everybody was too heavy into the Pretty in Pink. Fuck if I know, right? They're loving the John Hughes stuff a little bit too much at this point, and they're not ready for Highlander yet. But to me, like I said off the top, it's always stuck out to me because of that Queen soundtrack. Like, that, the look is great and everything. The way it comes together, and we'll get into our final thoughts a little bit later on, but, like, that Queen soundtrack made it stand out to me, even when I was young. It's like, oh, you know, this isn't just your normal 80s soundtrack here. This is top level shit, you know?
Yep. And it was Queen in there. You know how, well, of course, you being a huge Queen fan, you know how Queen has their metal sound, or at least very hard rock to metal.
Yeah.
They have their rock opera sound. They have the, and this was very much for, again, I'm 1986. I'm huge in the metal at this point. And Princes of the Universe song, as well as Hammer to Fall and all that, had that, the more metal edged Queen.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. This is the harder Queen for sure. You know, except for, like, Who Wants to Live Forever and,
you
know,
but
Wonder of Love and all
that. The scene they used it in, that fit perfectly. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. It really,
but there was all other references too, like the Def Leppard. Like, what's it, the Kurgan? Who's the actor?
Clancy Brown.
Yeah. They, you know, it's better to burn out and fade away, yeah. You know, which is a Def Leppard lyric.
As everybody in the church is just, he's just mocking them in the church.
Yeah. Walking out of the church, he turns around. I got something to say. It's better to burn out than fade away. But yeah, it's from, I think, Rock of Ages, that Def Leppard song. So there's all sorts of metal Easter eggs even in here, too. This movie itself is a very metal kind of movie.
You know, and Clancy Brown, by the way, has gone on to do, like, a shit ton of stuff in his career. Tons of awesome roles, memorable spots, and tons of movies, TV shows, and everything. But it's hilarious that the dude that's the Kurgan in this movie goes on to become the voice of Mr. Krabs in, like, 1,000 episodes of SpongeBob.
And it's funny because you can hear when he laughs.
Yeah.
You can almost hear Krabs in it.
Yeah. So it's got to be funny to certain people, like, because I'm sure there's a whole generation, obviously, that's kind of like, well, that's the voice of Mr. Krabs. But then there's, like, a generation of guys, you know, people like us that watched him in movies like this. And then you find out that dude's Mr. Krabs. You're like, what the fuck? You know, it's a whole different lens of looking at it, right?
Yeah.
Especially when he's in the church mocking, and doing, you know, the nuns walk by and he's like, blah, 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 you know, shit.
They have no humor.
Yeah. Mr. Krabs just like basically hit on some nuns, man. This is almost as fucked up as when we watched Microwave Massacre over on YouTube, you know, for the Video Vortex, and we find out that dude is fucking Frosty the Snowman. It's like, what? Yeah, go check that one out. It's on YouTube now. We encourage that one for that's a good episode. Yeah. Anyways, this movie stars, hold on, there we go. We got Christopher Lambert as Connor McLeod, Roxanne Hart as Brenda, Clancy Brown, of course, we just talked about as the Kurgan, Beatty Edney as Heather, and honestly, almost kind of randomly, Sean Connery as Ramirez. And I only say that because, yeah, like,
How ironic is it that there's a movie about Scottish Highlanders with Sean Connery, who's not playing a Scottish Highlander. He's playing a Spaniard, playing an Egyptian.
Yeah, well, that's got to do with the fact that the dude has lived 2,000-something years, right? You know, so I think he's lost all nationality at this point. Right? Someone has lived that long, but yeah, that's wild. But just the fact that he's in this, and it's a big role, but a small role, I think is the thing that I find weird about it. I mean,
he's doing, and he does a great job at it too. Like, he could have just walked through this role. Yeah. I mean, at this point, you know, he could have just been like, "Oh yeah, we got Sean Connery," and he's like, "Oh yeah, here's my script. Okay, blah, 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 blah. Oh, I'm done." I mean, I think he did great.
And the crazy thing is it doesn't look like they really marketed it that much with him in mind. You know, you talk about the poor marketing, but like, you look at the original theatrical poster for this. There's Christopher Lambert in the middle holding a sword, and then you see Clancy Brown in the background with the skull on his head, like the Kurgan. And, you know, it's a cool image, but there's no Sean Connery. His name is on the poster, but it's not like a leading line or anything like that. Not that he needed top billing, but you think they would have threw him on the poster or leaned into it a little bit. Like, hey, by the way, we got James Bond in this fucking movie.
And they would have been fully, fully
justified. Yeah.
Yeah. And doing that because, he might not be the star. He might be in a supporting type role, but he's in it certainly long enough for you to you know, had him on the poster or something.
Oh, absolutely.
Or, you know, somewhere push it, promote it a little bit more that way.
Yeah. I mean, it's not it's not Ozzy Osbourne and Gene Simmons and Trick or Treat levels, you know, and they use that to sell that movie, you know. Meanwhile, this is the opposite of that.
Yep.
To that, Donnie, you know, once again, he's not here, but he actually pulled some notes together, and he's got some, he pulled some interesting factoids on that side of things. Actors that were considered for, this is pretty interesting because it's three separate roles. Actors that were considered for the role of Ramirez, this is Sean Connery's role, they considered, before giving it to Connery, Lee Van Cleef, Clint Eastwood, Malcolm McDowell, Gene Hackman, Michael Caine, and Peter O'Toole. I mean, I think any of those would have been fine, but I think Lee Van Cleef is the one that's kind of like, what?
True. Yeah. You know, yeah. That's, I mean, well, now I could see them, not necessarily maybe his, I love Lee Van Cleef, but you know, he's usually a villain, almost, not always, but a lot of times he's playing a villain because of he's got this look about him or whatever, but also that look that he has about him is an international kind of look.
Yeah.
When you look at, you know, you can't place, so which would really fit the role of Sean Connery in here is supposed to be, like you said, you know, of not like from one place anymore, you know,
which
he's an immortal.
Like you pointed out with the way Sean Connery portrayed it too, is like, he didn't even try to hide his accent.
Yeah.
You know, he's just being Sean Connery playing, like you said, an Egyptian that is claiming to be Spanish or, you know, whatever the hell was going on there. But it's like that he didn't even try to put in anything. He didn't fake anything. He's just like, no, I'm just going to be myself, you know? Fuck it.
Oh, speaking of dialects, though, in this movie, like Christopher Lambert.
Oh, that's a weird one.
Himself. And I believe he's French, or he was French. And I remember reading something where he had just started really learning English not too long before this movie, I believe. And so you can tell that he's got, you know, his accent, he's got some sort of accent, but you can't really quite place it. And they worked with that by saying that, you know, he says it in here that he's from all over. Mm-hmm. Where are you from? I'm from everywhere. I'm from all, you know, because he's been throughout these lifetimes, he's lived in all kinds of different places. So he would maybe pick up on this accent of this place if he was in there for a long length of time.
Yeah, that is the beauty of this movie, is that you can get away with that, you know,
yeah,
these weird accents and stuff, like, that's weird. And then you're like, well, wait a minute. They are hundreds, if not thousands of years old. They might have picked up some weird ways of talking. So, okay, you know, moving on. But
the other thing, why is Sean Connery swinging a samurai sword? I mean,
well,
first of all,
I mean,
they perfectly explain why, you know, how he got the sword and who gave it to him, and the immortals aren't, you know, it's not, the things you expect maybe by watching it. So this is an amalgamation. Oh, they just thought these swords were cool, so they threw them in the movie, the samurai sword. He's not a samurai. It's like, why would he have it?
Yeah.
But they explain why. He's immortal and he was in Japan. It was given to him as a gift from, the certain Japanese person or whatever. So it's so there's very much reasons why they have why they wield the swords they wield and all that stuff too. So yeah. It's not just random. This sword is cool, so I'm going to use it type thing.
Other actors considered slash approached for the role of Connor McLeod were Kurt Russell, Michael Douglas, Kevin Costner, Mel Gibson, Peter Weller, Mickey Rourke, Sting, and apparently there was some soundtrack consideration with Sting too. Like, well, if we get him, then the soundtrack stuff, right? And then the last one, yeah. And this one's hilarious that Donnie noted. According to Hulk Hogan, Hulk Hogan. So apparently, brother, they wanted him to be the Highlander.
There could only be only one brother.
Brother. And lastly, actors considered for the role of the Kurgan. A couple of these I could totally believe. Arnold Schwarzenegger, Rutger Hauer, Nick Nolte, Sean Connery, who actually chose the role of Ramirez instead, Roy Scheider, that's weird, and Scott Glenn. So I could totally see Schwarzenegger, even Rutger Hauer or Nick Nolte.
Yeah.
Roles, but Sean Connery, he probably chose better. I mean, of the two roles, I mean, I'm sure he would have done fine, but Roy Scheider.
Yeah.
That's weird. What the?
Yeah. Definitely different than the other ones they had picked in that category.
Yeah. Well, that's all I have for the background. Was there anything else you wanted to point out before we got into it?
And I think that was one correction real quick.
Okay.
I think I mentioned that this, what was the director's name again? I can't think of his, I don't know why I can't think of his name.
Oh, it's Russell Mulcahy.
Russell McKay. Yeah. I think I mentioned that this was his first movie beyond music videos, but I was wrong. It's actually a movie that I thought was underrated back then. I need to revisit now. Maybe I need to pick it at some point for the show. It's called Razorback.
Hmm.
I don't know if you ever seen that one.
No.
Yeah, it's a killer pig movie, a razorback, like in Australia, the outback
mm-hmm.
razorbacks, like a boar, I guess, basically. But yeah, I remember watching that back in the day and thinking it was kind of underrated. But I didn't realize he had directed it. But that was, I believe, his first breakout movie beyond the music videos.
Hurry, hurry, step right this way, folks, for the most extravagant array of refreshment goodies ever assembled under one roof. Enjoy breathtaking, taste-tempting candies of finest quality. Enjoy popcorn exploded into tender, delicious, crispy bites of crunchy goodness. Enjoy the Tops in cool, refreshing soft drinks. If you want to enjoy some refreshments, this is your opportunity. There will now be a short intermission.
For you, the listeners of the All-American Spook Show podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. So I went on over to audible.com and I just typed in Highlander to see what would pop up. And I've got over 1,000 results, believe it or not. But Tiana, I don't want to be sexist or anything, but this looks like it's probably right up your alley more so than Smoking Eyes alley, because it looks like it's a lot of romance novels. I don't know if you're into romance novels. There's a ton romance novels that have something to do with Highlander.
I guess because of the romance in it.
The romance angle between him but you said they're linked to the Highlander universe?
I don't think so. This doesn't look like
okay.
No, I think this is just like, hey, do you love buff Scottish warriors?
Oh, okay.
There's a lot of romance for Scottish, especially men that wear kilts.
Yeah, well, that's what it looks like here. That's what I'm seeing. I've got Join a Highlander. Highlander Across Time, Book 4 by Rebecca Preston. I've got The Highlander's Return, a novel by Lindsay Sands. And I'm telling you, like, these are all, like, buff dudes in kilts, holding swords, right at Will's alley. Tons. I'm telling you, over 1,000 results, and almost everything I'm seeing is that. So apparently that's a thing. That's a really big thing, apparently. No pun intended. But if any of that floats your boat, and it looks like it floats a lot of boats, Go on over to audibletrial.com/spookshow today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/spookshow for your free audiobooks. And now I'm going to hop back over to IMDb and click on plot summary. If I can, the internet plays with me here and scroll down. Where the hell is it? Okay, here we go. Plot summary. Let's see if we got a, you know, it's funny. Like there was a couple weeks there where Donnie wasn't here. And then like, we only had like one sentence ones. And then as soon as he comes back, we got these 10 paragraph ones. But now this is another one where there's some long ones. So I'll read the brief one and then one long one. All right. So we've got an immortal Scottish swordsman must confront the last of his immortal opponents, a murderously brutal barbarian who lusts for the fabled prize. And then we've got this one submitted by Claudio Carvola from Rio de Janeiro on IMDb. In New York City, the owner of a sophisticated antique shop, Russell Edwin Nash, is challenged to a sword fight in the parking lot of the Madison Square Garden. That's as random as it sounds, by the way. By a man called Iman Fassel that is beheaded by Russell. He hides his sword and is arrested by the police while leaving the stadium. Russell recalls his life in the 16th century in Scotland when he is Connor MacLeod and is fatally wounded in a battle against another clan. However, he surprisingly survives, and his clan believes he has a pact with the devil and expels him from their lands. Then he meets Juan Sanchez Villalobos Ramirez, who explains that he is immortal unless he is beheaded. Further, the immortals dispute a game. The immortals dispute is a game killing each other, and in the end, only one survives, receiving a prize with the power of the other immortals. Russell is released by the police, but the snoopy forensic agent Brenda is attracted to the case since she found fragments of an ancient katana and follows Russell. But the also immortal Kurgan is hunting down MacLeod, and Brenda is in the middle of their battle. So, yeah, I mean, I guess you start there with just, you know, we've talked a ton about the Queen soundtrack, but I mean, it kicks in right out the gate, right? Like, it's pretty much one of the first things is that Princess of the Universe playing, right?
Yeah, right after the Sean Connery's narration, right? The prologue narration.
You get the brief narration of kind of explaining that, like, well, you've never heard about us and no one knows about us until now. And then Princess of the Universe kicks in.
And then
we get the fabulous Freebirds. I got to say, like I said, I've seen this a long time, but it's, you know, tons of times, but it's been a long time since I watched it. Boy, that one caught me like a 2x4 to the head. I had forgot. Completely forgot. I was like, whoa, what?
And how do you forget? I don't know.
But it's, you know, I guess it's so throwaway and has nothing to do with the story itself other than it is kind of weird to set up. I mean, like, look, it's a cool shot where, like, all right, here the wrestlers are coming out. They got this cool, like, crane shot that kind of pulls away, like it's circling the ring, and then it pulls back and zooms in on MacLeod sitting up in the, you know, in the crowd. But then I'm just like, wait a minute, why the hell is MacLeod at a wrestling match? That's the weird setup.
Yeah. And although, like you said, it's very, again, this is part of that music video thing. Like, I didn't realize it before. I just always thought it was a cool shot. I mean, actually, I've forgotten about it. Like you said, I forgot the whole opening and the wrestling thing. But as you're watching it, then I remember it. And I'm like, yeah, this is cool. I mean, like the crane shot thing and the camera going around the wrestling ring. And then, like you said, going up. And then here's Connor up in the stand. And then going back to the wrestling match and everything, too. So, I mean, it was a cool shot, but it is less wrestling and more music video cinematography.
Yeah, because you've got Princess of the Universe playing while, you know, they're wrestling in the ring and everything, but the cool shot and everything, you know, you just kind of comes back around. But who's wrestling in that is the fabulous Freebirds versus Greg Gagne, Jim Brunzel, and the Tonga Kid. So it's one of those random wrestling history trivia type things, like, you know, just randomly inserted into this thing for no particular reason. Story-wise, now, here's the other, still cool.
I'm guessing it was strictly set up for this movie, right? It wasn't
I would assume so, yeah.
I mean, it wasn't like they were just setting up at some wrestling match and like, oh, by the way, we're going to be doing this crane shot thing and all that, too. I mean, I'm assuming it was just this movie and that's it.
Yeah, because the whole setup is weird because, like, you know, me being a fan of wrestling and knowing where some of these dudes were at the time period and everything like that, I don't think almost none, if maybe one or two of these guys even had anything to do with the WWF at the time. And the WWF notoriously is basically the only group that ever got to run, pretty much ever gets to run the Madison Square Garden. And that's where they are, right? They're at Madison Square Garden. So that's kind of one of those weird wrestling connections is like these dudes probably wouldn't have been wrestling at the Garden, and you know, in the mid-80s. But so that tells me that they had to have purposefully, I don't know the story of that, but they had to have purposefully got these guys to come in and do this for just for this. So
yeah,
somebody listening out there, if you're a bigger wrestling fan or the history of that part of it, maybe you can explain it a little better. But either way, it's still kind of a cool time capsule kind of thing to, especially nowadays with the Fabulous Freebirds, right? With the rebel flag on their, on the robe and everything. Like it was kind of controversial at the time, much less now. Right.
It is all sequenced too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Didn't expect to get slapped with the stars and bars at the beginning of Highlander, but there it is. But yeah.
Oh, like, well, that's not the only, that's not, we can't, there's some things we can't say. Like, you know, based on the climate of the day and things change.
Oh, you
as
mean
far
some
as
of the, some of the
dialogue?
Yeah, yeah, the, yeah. That's the world. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah.
We can't even bring that dialogue up on the show.
Yeah,
we run off of YouTube.
Well, well, yeah, we're not going to quote it directly, but trust me, if you've ever seen this or when you do watch it, there's a couple salty moments in this. So just get ready if you if you're you're not ready for it. We're warning you. Not that it's prevalent and you see a bunch, but there's a couple of times where you're like, whoa, okay, you know, things you wouldn't hear today.
It just lets you know how various things change.
Yeah, sensibilities and, you know, what's cool, what ain't, yeah, all that. But this leads directly to a parking lot sword fight. And like the lower level parking lot, just he goes out there, pulls out a fucking sword, and then another dude shows up and they go to town and he beheads the guy. I love during the fight though, the dude just fucking backflips away.
Yeah, just so, yeah, all of a sudden it turned into, you know, I'm used to that from I talk about it on elsewhere. I don't know if I ever talk about it on the show, but Godfrey Ho ninja movies,
mm-hmm.
where it's just ninjas cartwheeling. They don't really have particularly good martial arts skills, but or weapons fighting skills, but they're a hell of a good gymnast and they'll cartwheel the hell out of, you know,
yeah,
out of the person that they're fighting.
Yeah, I mean,
this guy was obviously had some good, you know, there was good skill in the sword fighting and everything. But yeah, then the cartwheeling.
Yeah, they got some dude that could do some mad backflips, and they're just like, you know what? Fuck it, we're putting it in here.
Yeah.
We want you to do is just backflip as much as you can down this row of cars. Just go. He probably cuts about 85 backflips. You know, I'm not. I grew up in South Carolina. You know, I'm from the Carolinas, but I've always heard jokes about New Jersey. You know, not being the coolest part. Tiana, I think you're up from that general area, right? Does Jersey suck?
Most of it. I'm from the South, so it's more country.
Okay. But still, like, you're in the general region, closer than we are now, right? So is this a joke? Like, is this always a thing where people are like, yeah, Jersey sucks? Because it seems like there was like 85 Jersey sucks jokes in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
I don't even know. Is it a thing between South and North New Jersey, or no? Or is it more so New York, New Jersey?
I think New York.
New Jersey thing.
Yeah, well, that's definitely the angle that's taken here too. Like, well, it could, you know, it's the old like, well, it could be worse, but could be in Jersey. You know, that is played out a couple of times. So it's like, and is this always a thing there?
Yeah,
I do remember too. Back in this time period, that the stand-up comedian jokes were that way too, you know?
Yeah.
Like if you had stand-up comedian from New York, there was always going to be some sort of dig at New Jersey and vice versa.
It's always the, well, you know, things suck, but it could be worse. We're in New Jersey. I do love talking about the Queen soundtrack when the Kurgan is going down the road early on, you know, in modern times, not one of the many flashback sequences. He's going down the road in one of the modern times, and he just pops in the tape into the tape deck, and he's jamming out. I think it's Hammer to Fall, right? It's one of the Queen songs. He's jamming out.
Yeah.
Boy, that's once again, another one of those time capsule type moments, right? With the popping the tape in the tape deck and jamming out.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember having a cassette deck in a car. I don't remember which one it was I had, but it was one that was way later though. You would have thought that they would have just been CDs at that time. But.
Yeah. Oh no, Sam, I had two different cars, my first two cars. So this is like late 90s, early 2000s. Both of my first two cars still had tape decks.
Yeah.
But you're not that far removed from that time period, you know, like you had to get a newer car even then to have CD players and the more fancier
stuff. Oh yeah. Yeah. I think that was, wasn't that the first year of CDs was 86. I mean, the first, well, you know, first year that they were commercially available.
Yeah, it would have been sometime around this time period. Yeah. But I honestly, you know, yeah, it would have been, most people still would have been rocking tape decks even at this point. How about when he gets into another fight, or there's another fight? Who's he fighting? It might have been the Kurgan, one of those fights. Yeah, it was. I think it might have been the first time that McCloud and Kurgan come together. And then that random police chopper just bust in. Hey, you guys break it up.
Yeah.
Huh? I don't think this is the way the police choppers would have been deployed.
I don't think so, yeah. I think they would have had better things that they were, you know. Well, first of all, if they came across that, they would be calling them backup or something. There's two people sword fighting, and, you know, like... He might need to send a unit in there. I don't know.
That's the best part, is they're like, hey, break it up. And then when they run away, they're like, hey, come back here. What? But I'm fully convinced, though, that the only reason Ramirez, the Sean Connery character, even exists is to get through a shit ton of exposition. Because really, up to that point in the movie, none of this is really explained that well. You're like, what the fuck? You know, really, if you hadn't watched this before, maybe go back to the first time you watched it, you'd be like, what the fuck is going on here? Like, you don't know that this guy's immortal. You think he might be. You don't know what the hell. He just beheaded a guy down in the down in the parking lot of Madison Square Garden. There's a bunch of flashbacks that, you know, you kind of put two and two together, but you don't really know until Ramirez shows up and then explains everything. Oh yeah, you're immortal because. That's one thing too that's never really explained, right? Maybe it is in subsequent movies and later on, like what makes them immortal, or maybe I just missed it. There's just certain people that are just immortal.
Yeah, I don't remember hearing who's chosen for what reason or whatever.
Yeah, why are they immortal and how? But like the only thing that he explains is that, yeah, you're immortal. You can be hurt, stabbed, burned, whatever the fuck. You can drown, but you can't die unless somebody cuts your head off. That's the only way. You're going to die. And also, we won't fight each other if you're in a holy place. So, you know, I guess you can hang out at churches the rest of your life, right? You'd be all right. And then, you know, there's a few other tidbits. And then he basically kind of shows up to explain this to him and train him. And then Kurgan shows back up and then kills him. So, you know, and this all takes place over, what, about 20, 25 minutes of the movie? Connery in, Connery out. But you're wiser for his presence. He knows all you're really left with there, right?
Yep.
Now,
that was a cool scene too. That was a cool setup.
Kurgan and Ramirez. Yeah,
really going cool. up the steps to that thing, and then the whole thing is crumbling, and all it is the stairway is the only thing left.
Yeah, and you got like the thunderstorm going on, so there's a lot of cool stuff going on in the background, and every strike of the sword like is caving this fucking house in. Or castle, whatever the hell this place is. Yeah, it's visually, it's cool. For sure. It's a cool scene, brought together well. So you know what's going on, at least from this point forward. So a lot of the movie really is kind of flashbacks. You know, let's go back to when he first realized he's immortal, I guess. He gets stabbed and then comes back to
life. The French duel, I think it was France, the duel.
Oh, yeah, the one in the 1700s. He keeps getting stabbed and whatnot and cut and everything, and he won't die. And then eventually he's just like, I'm sorry for what I've done. And then walks away. And then the dude's
I know I got him. I'm pretty sure I stabbed him right through a few times.
Yeah. And then the other guy just shows up with pistols. Shoot him. And then he just shoots him for some reason. I don't know what the fuck. I guess that's your brief comedic moment, right? Your comic relief.
Yeah.
your comic interlude stuck in the middle of this. But yeah, that Kurgan killing Ramirez, that was a really cool scene. But then you get kind of the once again, another sad scene, and this is where Who Wants to Live Forever is playing, where they show McCloud with Heather, the woman that he falls in love with, and they live their whole life together. It's almost like that, you know, the scene from Up, where this is really fucking sad, you know? But, like, you show them live their whole life together, and now she's old, and he's still the same age, and... She basically what dies in his arms, right? And then that song's playing. So it's, you know, kind of an emotional part of the movie, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Very serious tone from that point. It's because, like, this movie, I don't know, it's part of the charm of it. I think it goes from badass action fight scenes to oddball humor, like the dueling scene we talked about, and some other points in the movie that are just kind of sort of oddball humor, just like pops his head up type thing.
Yeah.
And it to like very serious drama moments like this one.
Yeah. Yeah. And even like there's some, a little bit of comedy, but there's some seriousness in the World War II scene.
Oh yeah.
When he helps the little girl, which I guess that's the older woman, right? That's a flashback to when he helped.
Yeah.
Her.
The one.
Yeah.
Helping him in the modern time.
Yeah.
I can't remember that.
I think it's Rachel, but it flashes back to like, she met him back in he saved her life in World War II from a Nazi, and then flash forward, and you know, now she's here helping him out. But even that one's kind of like, yeah, it's a serious thing, obviously, but then there's some comedy in that too, right? Because he guns him down and says something like, "You're the master race," or whatever the line was.
Before he shoots him, yeah. Mm. So I don't know. Yeah, it is. And maybe that's why it was the critics didn't like it. Maybe they just didn't know what to make of it. I don't know.
Yeah, because it does jump around a lot. You know, like, it's I will say this. It's definitely not one of those movies you can watch in the background.
No.
Because it's so many flashbacks and so many exposition dumps with Ramirez and a couple other spots that, like, you really better be paying attention. Otherwise, you can be like, what the fuck is this movie? You know, so maybe there's a little bit of that going on with some people. I don't know.
Yeah.
And what was the deal with the one guy that was, like, half Punisher, half Rambo that decided to, like, I'm going to take these guys out. He's got like an Uzi or he's got a machine gun or something. And it was.
And he has something like an ex-military.
Yeah, he's like ex.
Something.
Yeah, he was ex-military gun aficionado type or something. And he like.
And they didn't even like bother asking like why he had that kind of gun.
Why he just blasted on him.
Hey, I'm sorry you got ran through and you know, it's good you're okay, but why were you acting like the Punisher in an alleyway? What the fuck is going on here, buddy? That was kind of stuck in there and weird, but you know, still cool. Once again, another cool sword fight scene you got out of it, right? But so it was just kind of, who is this guy?
It is also maybe something that would happen in a music video.
Yeah. Whatever. Well,
I think there's a lot of quirkiness that when you're watching it, I don't, you know, it all flows together just fine or whatever I think, but I mean,
there's
a lot of quirkiness in this movie that you don't like, you know, when you analyze it, you're like, why is it just there?
But eventually Kurgan kidnaps and just basically he kidnaps Brenda and then just terrorizes her, right? Like, he's just driving around in the city at high speeds, literally like running people over, you know, just fucking terrorizing her. And then that leads to the big dramatic epic final battle between McCloud and Kurgan, though, which is, once again, it needs to be witnessed to be seen. I mean, like, it really is. Once again, you go back to the music video thing. It does feel like that, you know, because you got like the dramatic, like windows blowing, glass everywhere, and they got the wind machines going, so their hair, you know, like everything about it is just epic in scope, you know. But it's the lighting, you know, just everything about it. It looks really cool, you know, the lighting and backgrounds with the silhouettes of the sword fight and everything. Really well shot. Yep.
You don't usually see when somebody's choreographing sword fight scenes, you don't usually see something when the camera is like way back in the back. You know those shots?
Yeah.
The shots where the windows are up front and lit blue and all that. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden they're going to the camera that's way back to where it makes them look like they're a mile away almost. Mm-hmm. I mean, it looks cool. But again, that's part of that music video thing, I think. But it's something that if you weren't well versed in shooting things that way, you wouldn't think to set the camera up in the back of the room to film this sword fight thing. I mean, and it isn't, the whole thing isn't shot that way. It's just that it goes back there for some shots and then comes back to them in the forefront fighting or whatever. And it just is a cool juxtaposition, I guess, of far off shot versus them, you know, close in fighting. It's just something you don't see when you're seeing sword fighting usually. So I guess that's why it sticks out to me.
A lot of like one take looking kind of shots too, you know, where it's kind of like it's on a crane or something and it's kind of sliding back and forth while they're doing it. I mean, it's just, it's really well put together, well shot, great editing and everything here. Great effects, all of it. Just, it comes together really well here for the climax. And,
it's definitely epic because it goes on for a good while. I mean,
it's like, you know, solid.
Good way. It doesn't overstay its welcome. I mean, it's just a great epic battle.
Mm-hmm. But it, of course, ends with McCloud eventually decapitating Kurgan and then him kind of getting all the power, so to speak, and then he just yells out, "There can be only one," which we find out, I guess, apparently there's more than one, because they made four more movies in an entire series, but there's that.
There can be another one.
Yeah.
And there can be even another one.
Turns out I was wrong. There can be many.
And I don't know if we talked that. I don't know if we kind of mentioned it offline, but I don't think we talked about it online. If anybody's seen, I've never seen any sequel. The only Highlander movie I've ever seen has been the first one. And I think it's because I got soured on people saying, you know, well, the other ones weren't worth a shit. So
yeah,
I don't know. At some point we'll probably get to them on the podcast, but I've never seen any. So I don't know if y'all have seen any of the
sequels. Yeah, I'm pretty sure I've seen two and maybe three, but past that, no. And I used to watch the show off and on, you know, we talked about that briefly. Yeah, but the other sequels were Highlander 2, The Quickening in 1991. Then in 1994, there was Highlander 3, The Sorcerer. Then in 2000, so that's usually our line of embarkation from old to new or whatever. So I don't have high hopes for anything past that. Highlander Endgame was in 2000. And then in 2007, Highlander, The Source. Now, apparently Christopher Lambert was in those first four, but he was not in that fifth, Highlander, The Source. And also there was Highlander, the series, which ran from 1992 to 1998. And I believe that was like a syndicated type show. You know, it didn't air on one particular network here in the U.S. So you probably saw it here, there, and everywhere. But it did have, you know, 119 episodes, six seasons. So that was probably something that you might have ran across at some point in the middle of the 90s there. And probably still gets replayed on one channel or another these days, right? Somewhere. It has lived on, and I'm sure we're not done with it. I would imagine at some point, right, with the way they like to revive things these days, you know, I'm sure at some point there'd be something else, right? There actually was a short-lived animated series too, Highlander the Animated Series, which ran for a couple years in mid 90s, and then there was another one called Highlander the Raven. That was another series, a spinoff of Highlander the series. Which looks like it might have lasted, yeah, only one season, that one, Highlander the Raven. But yeah, I'm just give it time. I'm sure it'll come back in some form or another, because there's been books, comic books, audio originals. There's even been some video games. Mm-hmm. Going all the way back to 86, there was one that I think came out on Atari or whatever the hell. Well, it says Commodore 64, ZX Spectrum. Boy, that's some stuff I haven't heard of in a while. But yeah, so various, a little bit of everything for Highlander. It became a thing, which is kind of weird for something that was not highly successful when it came out in 1986, to your point earlier, that it spawned this much, you know, but there we are. So that's pretty much where we'll leave that before we get into our ratings here. So this is Cult Corner, so we still give it a star rating, but we're comparing this to other movies that we've done on Cult Corner. We're not necessarily comparing this to Gone with the Wind or on the other side, closer to Gone with the Wind, I guess, but you're not really comparing this to, say, Microwave Massacre or anything you know, that type of stuff that we've done over on the podcast, Street Trash, right? Something like that. So with that being said, Tiana, what do you think? Where's this at? What's your final thoughts and your star rating?
I really enjoy this one for the action and the actors and especially the soundtrack. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to give it a 4.5.
Smoke, what do you say?
Same thing like we've been talking about throughout this whole thing. It's an enjoyable, every time I see it, I never get tired of it. So I've seen it more than a handful of times probably, and I'm sure I'll see it plenty more. And it's one of those movies where you can put on, like you said, you don't put it on in the background. You know, it's not what you, like anytime it's on, I get sucked into it and I'm gonna pay attention to it. But at this point, you can put it on in the background, and it'll just basically be the sound of sword fighting and Queen, you know.
Yeah. As God intended it.
Yes. I love this movie, so I think I'll give it 4 stars.
Yeah, I mean, I'll for same reasons and various. I mean, I love the soundtrack and everything, and it kind of holds a special place because I've seen it so many times, and I used to watch it a lot when I was, somewhere between the age of 8 to 18, somewhere around there. I saw it a handful of times. It's been a while, but yeah, I think I'm going to go solid 4 stars. It's an enjoyable flick. Yeah, certain parts of it, like any movie, when you pick it apart, you're like, well, that doesn't make sense. But yeah, I think they do a pretty good job of explaining, because really, if you think about this thing as a whole, it's pretty outlandish, right? And they explain it well enough, although there are certain aspects of it they don't explain, like why are these people immortal? Where do they come from and everything? And maybe some of that stuff's expanded on in later installments. But if you're just talking about this movie by itself, they don't do a good job of explaining that. But once you get the premise, you can go with it and have fun with it, you know? And yep. Even though it does jump around in time and everything, they make it make sense. And it flows pretty well for a long movie. So I think it's pretty solid. So yeah, I'm with you. I'll give it 4 stars. So that means overall, you know, without Will and Donnie's 2 cents one of these days, we give it 4.1 out of 5 stars. So obviously we highly recommend it. You know, we have spoiled it, but we have not spoiled it entirely for you in terms of like some of the stuff just needs to be seen because it's a very visual movie. So we recommend you go track it down in its various forms. Go find it on 4K because it looked the transfer looked pretty good to me. So go check it out there. Highly recommend it. So we don't do Donnie's not here to do the cult connection, so we don't do any of the other normal jazz. So that's pretty much where we'll leave it. So next week here on the podcast, it's Donnie's choice, and he's not here to announce it, but he's already told us what it's going to be. And Smoke, you're going to love this. This is right up your alley. We're going back to Hellraiser. We're visiting our old pal Pinhead. You know, and he said, and you know, he sent us that email, you know, that he loved the show so much that he'll be excited to know that we're going to be talking about Hellraiser Hell World from 2005. Now, this one sticks out in Hellraiser history as the last one with Doug Bradley. Jesus, I can't believe I forgot his name. This is the last one where Doug Bradley portrayed Pinhead. So if you think they've been pretty bad the last handful, I have a feeling it might get worse.
Hold on to my puzzle box.
Yeah, we don't even have Doug Bradley to look forward to after this one. So, and yes, there are more after this. God almighty, this series won't end. But Donnie picked it because he's the one that kind of fell on the sword, so we can finally get one more out of the way here. So next week we'll be talking about Hellraiser Hell World. So we'll leave it there for now. So for Will and Donnie, couldn't be with us. Tiana, Professor Smoke, I'm Josh. We are the All-American Spook Show, and we'll open up the lament configuration one more time next week.
And now, folks, it's time to say goodnight. We sincerely appreciate your patronage and hope we've succeeded in bringing you an enjoyable evening of entertainment. Please drive home carefully and come back again soon. Good night.